Welcome to SCOTUS-CAST. On March 25th, 2008, the court heard oral argument in the consolidated cases of Muna v. Garin and Garin v. Omar on federal court's jurisdiction over habeas claims of U.S. citizens held in Iraq. George Mason University Law Professor Ron Rotunda discusses the cases. As always, the Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker. And now, Professor Rotunda.
On March 25th, the U.S. Supreme Court heard oral argument in Muna v. Garin and Garin v. Omar. Like ancient Gaul, one can divide the major players in this litigation into three parts. First, there's the multinational force in Iraq, an internationally authorized entity consisting of military forces from about 27 nations, including the U.S. This force operates in Iraq at the request of the Iraqi government and pursuant to U.N. Security Council resolutions authorizing it to take all steps necessary to secure and stabilize Iraq. The multinational force operates under a uniform command of U.S. military officers, but is legally distinct from the U.S. military. It has its own insignia, and it includes high-ranking officers from other nations. For example, the second-in-command is a British officer. The first litigant is Mohammed B. Muna. He's a dual American-Iraqi citizen who is a resident of Romania. He voluntarily traveled to Iraq in 2005 to serve as a translator and a guide for Romanian journalists. Shortly after their arrival, they were promptly kidnapped, and terrorists held them for about 2 months. The multinational force eventually freed them, but then detained Munaf as a suspect in the kidnapping. Munaf admitted on camera and in writing, and in front of an Iraqi investigative court, that he was an accomplice in the kidnapping for a profit scheme in the assault and the kidnapping of the Romanian journalists. Munaf also appeared as a witness against his accomplices, including his own brother-in-law. A lawyer whom Munaf chose represented him at the hearings, and he had an opportunity to present evidence and call witnesses. The Iraqi investigative court referred the case to trial. At the trial, both Munaf and his co-defendants testified and recanted their confessions. They alleged the Iraqis or the Romanians had forced them to confess. The Iraqi court tried and convicted Munaf of participation in the kidnapping-for-hire scheme, sentenced him to death. Recently, the Iraqi appellate court reversed that conviction and remanded for a new trial. That brings us to the third actor, Shaqiq Omar, an American Jordanian citizen who voluntarily traveled to Iraq in 2002. He said he was seeking work in the reconstruction of Iraq. No Iraqi court has yet tried Omar because the district court for the District of Columbia enjoined the multinational force from transferring him to Iraq or allowing the Iraqi courts to try him. The multinational force captured Omar in October 2004 during a raid of his Baghdad home. This raid targeted associates of al-Zarqawi, the former head of al-Qaeda in Iraq. The multinational force found Omar harboring an Iraqi terrorist and four Jordanian terrorists. It also found several weapons, explosive-making materials in Omar's home. When the multi-force captured them, the terrorists who were caught with Omar stated that while living in his home in Baghdad, they conducted surveillance on potential kidnap victims and engaged in weapons training. These individuals and Omar also said that Omar planned to use his fluency in English to lure foreigners to his home so they could kidnap and ransom them. At the request of the Iraqi government, both Omar and Munaf are in custody of the U.S. military personnel as part of that multinational military coalition. One of Omar's wives and a son filed a habeas petition for Omar. Munaf's sister filed a habeas petition for him. Both of these cases were brought in the District Court for the District of Columbia. One panel of the D.C. Circuit ruled it had no jurisdiction over Munaf because neither the multinational force nor the Iraqi courts are a tribunal of the United States, and U.S. courts only have habeas jurisdiction over these tribunals. A different panel of the D.C. Circuit said that it had jurisdiction over Omar because no Iraqi court had yet convicted him for his alleged criminal offenses. It upheld the trial court's injunction forbidding the U.S. from transferring Omar to Iraqi custody. And then it also forbade the U.S. from releasing Omar or sharing information with the Iraqi government, because that would enable Iraq to arrest Omar and prosecute him in the Iraqi courts. There are two major legal questions that the parties have asked the Supreme Court to decide. First, whether U.S. courts have jurisdiction to entertain a habeas corpus petition filed on behalf of an individual such as Omar or Munaf challenging their detention by the multinational force. And secondly, if there is jurisdiction, does the district court in Omar have the power to enjoin the multinational force from releasing Omar to Iraqi custody or allowing Iraqi courts to try him? Two precedents are most relevant. The first dates back from shortly after World War II, Perot v. MacArthur in 1948, the short per curiam opinion. It held that the United States courts lacked jurisdiction over habeas petitions filed by Japanese nationals held abroad by a multinational force, in this case the Allied Powers, pursuant to international authority. Perot, however, did not involve a U.S. citizen, a point that the D.C. court did not find relevant, but something that the parties are arguing before the U.S. Supreme Court. The D.C. Circuit emphasized a different distinction, that no Iraqi court had yet convicted Omar for his alleged criminal offenses. The second precedent is Wilson v. Girard, 1957, also per curiam. The issue in that case is whether a Japanese court could try Girard, a U.S. soldier, for accidentally causing the death of a Japanese woman. The U.S. ultimately notified Japan it would deliver Girard to Japanese authorities for trial. Japan then indicted him, and Girard sought a habeas corpus writ from the District of Columbia District Court. A treaty with Japan gave the United States jurisdiction over offenses committed in Japan by members of the U.S. military, but provided that the U.S. could waive its jurisdiction. The Supreme Court said first, and I'm quoting now, quote, a sovereign nation has exclusive jurisdiction to punish offenses against its laws committed within its borders, unless it expressly or impliedly consents to surrender its jurisdiction, end quote. Then the Girard Court held that under these circumstances there was no constitutional or statutory bar to the United States allowing Japan to try a U.S. soldier. Wilson says that the United States may surrender custody of a U.S. citizen to a foreign sovereign when the individual is in that foreign country, unless a treaty or statute bars transfer. The major issue in Omar and Manaf are whether a U.S. citizen held by the multinational force under the command of the U.S. military in a foreign war zone, whether they are entitled to the rights of having an American judge examine the legality of their detention. Lawyers from Omar and Manaf argue that American law in these circumstances applies to the U.S. military, no matter where the capture takes place. Moreover, they say, their clients are innocent and face torture if the United States turns them over to the Iraqi government. The U.S. argues that the court has no jurisdiction under the Hirota case. In addition, it says that Wilson v. Girard controls, and that Omar and Manaf should have no more rights than a U.S. soldier. If the court finds that there is jurisdiction, it will be interesting to see what it does to Wilson v. Girard. On occasion, the United States, relying on Girard, turns over U.S. soldiers to Japan or South Korea, Germany, other places where we have military bases. Sometimes the United States tries the soldier itself, but in some circumstances it waives its jurisdiction. Under Girard, that waiver was constitutional. Whether it remains constitutional is a major issue in this case.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUSCast. For more episodes of SCOTUSCast, as well as audio and video from past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.